So, this is the Fuel Podcast for, I don't know when. My name's Ian. There are other people here. It's never mattered that other people have been here, because it's all about me, as we all know. We're going to, at some point, be reviewing another long-titled good movie. In this case, it's... I already gave it away. We don't even need to review it, do we?
What?
I said it was a good movie, like, objectively. Like, it just counts as a
good
movie.
There Will Be Blood?
Yeah, but you kind of went into it knowing it was probably going to be a good movie, though, right?
Or
a great movie. You knew that if something was... If you didn't like it, it was just your fault, and you would just be like, you know, it's a good movie, but I didn't like it.
The commercial told me I'd love it.
Exactly. It was a masterpiece.
And it was...
You believe them.
You have no choice but to believe them.
I took their word for it.
That's right.
Like, molded my opinion of the movie around the commercial.
Of course you did. It's all that you can do.
So it's an Upton Sinclair book it's based off called Oil, which really has nothing to do with the plot.
Why don't you talk about that for a second at least? Okay. Just talk about what the book is maybe about and stuff.
Did you read it?
I did read it. No, I don't read. I don't read. It's a, according to Wikipedia, which doesn't tell lies, it's a third-person narrative. Its main character being some guy who... is the son of an oil tycoon, and he has sympathetic feelings toward socialists, and it causes problems with his father throughout the story, because his father's a very greedy capitalist guy, and it takes place in Southern California, and that's very, very loosely what that's about. So There Will Be Blood.
There's very little political aspect. There's no
the
socialism
sun.
And the
yeah,
sun.
There's no socialism.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's not even real.
Was the son death and death?
No, it's a real, you know.
Okay, so basically P.T. Anderson's filmography up till now is Sydney, or what's popularly known as Hard Eight. Though he will tell you that that's not the title, because he thinks it makes it sound like a porno movie. Mm-hmm. Which was about kind of a character study about... About a guy that was like a professional gambler.
No.
You really do have it, by the way. Okay, so... And, yeah, it had John C. Reilly in it. He was the main character. Well, I know, who was the main guy in Sydney? What's his name, the older guy?
What's that guy's name?
Never in anything where he's major.
Yeah.
He's, like, pretty much, but he was good in this.
Yeah.
I
could just look it up.
Anyway, John C. Reilly, before he pretty much was doing nothing but Brule's Rules and, comedy guest spots. Adam McKay movies. Back when he was still... And he's used John C. Reilly in just about every film, hasn't he? He was in
Boogie
Nights, and
he was
in
Magnolia. And he,
Was he in Punch Drunk Love?
I don't know if he was in Punch Drunk Love, actually.
Was he in Prairie Home Companion?
He was in Prairie Home Companion. He was in it with... he and Woody Harrelson were the cowboys who came on the show.
Cool.
I think
it seemed like a John C. Reilly role would have been the friend of Plainfield, the guy that was played by Caesar from on the HBO Rome show, if you know that actor.
Yeah.
Okay. He's the one that takes the son away to San Francisco in the middle, and then he sort of seems to be like his only... He's like a second, his right-hand man, sort of.
Right.
It seemed like that would have been an interesting... Would have been the kind of role that would have been a John C. Reilly type role... But, you know, he wasn't playing it. And I wonder if that's because he's been doing so much comedy, if it's kind of turned him into sort of a goofball and a joke,
right,
as far as people can think. Anyway, maybe that's not relevant. What did we really know about this film going into it?
Philip Baker Hall is that guy's name.
Philip Baker Hall, yeah.
It's one of those three names.
The guy that was in Sydney was named Philip Baker Hall.
And he was in Boogie Nights as well, and he was in Magnolia.
Yeah.
He's the same ensemble.
He's changed
it
up.
Which is why it was different than for There Will Be Blood, is the fact that he really goes away from any of his mainstays.
Yeah, there's almost no real
there's
known.
There's none that he uses.
Except for Daniel Day-Lewis.
Well, he used Daniel Day-Lewis, he used Kevin J. O'Connor.
Isn't really like a known.
And Siren something is the guy who's Daniel Day-Lewis's right hand man. The guy,
that guy.
That guy's stuff. Paul Dano, who's in.
Yeah, he's been in
Little
Miss
Sunshine.
Little Miss Sunshine
is the only thing.
Some other murder movie with, I forgot what it was. It's like a serial killer movie.
Really?
He played like the young serial killer, like the young version, you know, and then he grew up. I don't know.
Okay.
Taking Lives?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay.
So, what we knew is it had been in a while between Anderson films. His last film was Punch Drunk Love, which was maybe, 99?
Gosh,
or was it 2001? It couldn't have been much... It's been quite a few years, though. And here it is. It's 2000 and... I guess we'd call it 2007 was the proper release date for this.
When Shrunk Love was 2002.
2002, okay. So it's been 5 years without a film from P.T. Anderson. Yeah.
Much time he was kind of understudying for Altman and helping him along and being the insurance policy in case he died, since Prairie Home Companion was in the winter of his years, I guess you would say.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I didn't see it, but you said...
I didn't see it. It was very good.
You've said that you've read that it seemed like Anderson primarily sort of maybe took over the
director. Well, what I read was that he really was like a co-director throughout the thing. Because Altman was almost non-functional. But it was an Altman movie, 100%. Yeah. It didn't have any of P.T. Anderson style at all. Mm-hmm. There were no moving cameras. And, you know, it was basically... It was people walking into a room and two people having a conversation while someone else comes up and talks alongside them. And the Altman thing where the conversations just never
overlap. Yeah, like overlap, right now.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's great with Altman stuff. It's Gosford Park is one of my favorite movies, and it's really hard to understand what happens in it because there's so many conversations.
And they're so obscenely British.
I saw it at the Arcata Theater before they closed that down.
Oh, wow.
And the sound there was so bad. You could not understand. It's a huge screen. And their speakers were just so awful that somebody's huge face was up there, and they were like, and you just heard.
You couldn't watch Rambo in a movie.
No, you just heard it all mumbling.
Yeah. So going into this, we knew it had been a while since there'd been an Anderson film. There'd been some kind of anticipation about it. I think there'd been a little bit of buzz. There'd been a pretty interesting trailer released that I think it has definitely sort of a different aesthetic for him. Maybe not entirely, but
it did. I agree.
It could just be that it's a period piece, but
it was also set mainly outdoors, kind of in a desert area.
But it felt like it looked like the color scheme was these sort of these light blues and light browns, and it looked like an older like the way older westerns from the 60s and 70s look in terms of the sort of color balance and just the design of the film. I mean, compared to something like 310 to Yuma. Which sounded and it was thematically was very much so kind of a throwback to an old Western. It still looked like a new movie. It looked like, you know, like it was made in, you know, the mid 90s to now, and, you know, what it came out in 2007, right?
Yeah.
But this film looks like it just has that older look to it. And it doesn't look dingy. It isn't that. Would you agree? Would you disagree? Or
I'm not sure. I think it actually looked really sharp. And
well, no, it looked sharp.
It did have a grainy look to it, and it didn't. It wasn't as. I think it was the lack of filters that really set apart.
Yes,
because so many even dramas now use a filter, especially in sunlight times and stuff. And there wasn't that. It was just kind of like a stark.
It was like all the style,
light looking stuff.
All the style was in the set design and in the color that was there. Mm-hmm. It was all.
And there's a couple of scenes at night that were literally lit only with firelight. It was like a lot of really natural lighting in the whole film.
And in that sense, I think, is why... I mean, that and some of the pacing aspects, probably the fact that it was adapted from a book, but about a third of the way into it, to me, it felt a lot like a Stanley Kubrick film. And I started thinking... It felt a little bit like Barry Lyndon. I mean, and now you talk about the lighting issues, and I mean, that was the whole thing that happened with Barry Lyndon, as we know, that Kubrick built these lenses so that they could shoot with actual candlelight and get this but it gives a different aesthetic, obviously. It gives this sort of Renaissance era, romantic era painting look, but which isn't in There Will Be Blood, though it is kind of a Western. It's sort of the same time period, but not, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little further along.
It's a little bit out. It's like
maybe about 50 years,
yeah,
maybe even 100
set
years.
A little bit before like a Wild Bunch or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or probably concurrent with the Wild Bunch.
Well, I think the Wild Bunch was set in the like the 19-teens, for the
something
most
like
part.
That,
and this was mainly
it jumps
times like three different times or four even.
It's 1898.
The
then
bulk
it's
1902. The bulk of it was like 1902.
I think the bulk of it was 1911.
Might have been, and then at one point near the end it jumps to 1927 or something.
1928.
Like that.
Yeah. No, it was 27. You're right. It was right at the beginning of the Black Monday,
which is actually when Upton Sinclair's novel was written and set in. So it might have been him trying to change the thing to the rich father in his mansion is you know, that was basically his life up until that point or something like that.
Yeah,
so that
there was
sort of
definitely a choice in the adaptation of the book. It's kind of similar to what happened with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where the book's protagonist is more of a like side character in the main story.
Have you guys seen this, by the way? There Will Be Blood? Because we're going to be spoiling it.
Doesn't matter. So. My memory's so bad that, you know.
Okay.
Partially spoiling it, at least.
Yeah, we're going to just full-on talk about this film. Because it's been out for a Yeah. So it had been quite a few years. We'd seen some trailers for it and thought, this could be interesting. This could be. I was a little trepidatious because with Anderson stuff, I know sometimes it can be a little pretentious, yeah. A little heavy-handed. As soon as I got the inklings that it was maybe about oil, all I could think of is it's difficult not to contextualize that with the current political climate.
And it didn't do it at all.
It was
a purely thing about really simply like a capitalist agreement.
But I'm sure that guy that wrote the review about No Country for Old Men and compared it to Abu Ghraib will be able to draw all kinds of parallels between There Will Be Blood and the current situation.
I think they're both meant to be taken pretty much at face value. I read an interview recently with Brolin, Javier Bardem, and Tommy Lee Jones were all interviewed by somebody because they were all at some awards together.
Yeah.
And they were all very insistent that movie is meant to be taken very face value.
Oh, yeah.
And that, like, someone asked him about, like, Tommy Lee Jones, about the soliloquy he gives at the end and where he talks about the dream and stuff. And they were like, do you think that's about this? He's like, no. He's like, I talked to the Coens, and it's just meant to be exactly what he says. He's just talking about a dream he had.
Yeah.
That's it. And he's like, it's not.
It's the same as Fargo, where, you know, they're just, you know, I'm painting my stamp.
And I think that people like to read into this stuff so much, but when something is given to you as simply as There Will Be Blood or as No Country for Old Men, it's really hard not to say, well, this is a movie about.
It's usually more profound in the end too, because it's simple, it's not some metaphor for something, some deep academic talk thing. It's like just kind of throwing it out there. Like, this is kind of the way sometimes things are and people behave and so forth.
Because ostensibly, No Country for Old Men is exactly what the title is about.
Yeah.
And it turns out to not just be ostensibly, that's what it is about. That's what the whole movie is about.
It's
right there.
It's quite literally about that.
Yeah. And that ends up being the meaning and the theme and everything. And it's not any weaker for it. It's stronger for it, I think. And There Will Be Blood.
Keep it simple.
Is pretty much the same thing, except for it's...
Well, it implies another level of sort of anticipation.
Yeah.
No Country for Old Men is a blanket statement. It says...
Yeah.
It says what it is.
There Will Be Blood is also something that's very literal about the movie. And it has as much to do with... the protagonist or antagonist, I guess you'd say.
He's a protagonist.
Yeah, but gosh, he's the protagonist. The whole time I was watching the movie, I was thinking, "There's no way I can't see him as the bad guy."
He's the protagonist.
I know, but I mean, you know, he's also the antagonist.
Okay.
He's the protagonist.
So our protagonist in the film is played by the accomplished actor Daniel Day-Lewis, who's He comes from the school of method acting, which essentially means that he takes on that role for the entire time that he's playing that character. If he's dying of stomach cancer, say, in the ballad of, is it Jim and Rose?
Jack and Rose.
Then he's going to starve himself to death.
Technically, method acting is recalling times that you felt a certain emotion and then making yourself feel them again while you're
acting.
That's
sense memory, I think.
Well, that's method acting. That's the method. That's the Lee Strasberg graph.
Okay,
which he studied with. So
okay, good.
But he goes beyond that and does his own method thing, which he did for Gangs of New York, because he stays in character for the entire shooting.
So the film begins. First of all, let's say the soundtrack by
Johnny Greenwood,
lead guitarist for Radiohead, Johnny Greenwood, who I think sort of brings, definitely if you've heard, he's done a soundtrack for sort of a strange documentary called I think it's called Body Song,
right?
And I've listened to that, and that's got some pretty good stuff in it. This is a much more muted soundtrack, a lot more strings, and
there's a lot of claps, and sounds like people banging on pots.
A little bit of that, which is in Body Song, And so at the beginning of the film, you get some of this sort of eerie. That another thing is why it reminded me of Kubrick is I think the 2001 score, especially at the beginning. You're in a desert, and then you get this sort of eerie, like.
There's a lot of cacophony in it, and dissonant. A lot of dissonant things change going up and then back down.
It's really just giving you this like this whole like layer, this like foundation of tension before the film even
had anything
happen.
Fantastically, without any dialogue, and goes on for quite a while, basically showing this guy's drive and ambition and like never give up attitude when it comes to. Basically, like, I mean, his life is going to be attempting to make money, basically. And you get this whole thing just by watching him for 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much about greed, I would say, at the beginning, though.
You don't get that, but you get the idea that this guy is completely... He's doing this by himself. He's completely driven to do this thing, which is...
He's authentic about his drive, too.
He turns it right around. The first time you hear him talking is, you know, 15, 20 minutes into the film, he's talking to a group of people about how...
That's the first dialogue too. Yeah. It's his voice, but it is like you said, there's the first 15, 20 minutes of the film. Another reason why it reminded me of Kubrick with 2001 and everything. No dialogue at all. And I mean, it's not just that it's just him at the beginning. I mean, it's just him with no dialogue for, I would say, maybe about 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then it's other people in him, and they're doing something. It's showing that he's building something, that he's making progress towards a goal. And there is blood, there's violence, somebody gets killed.
I think the script was something like, it was like 150 pages or something mm-hmm. like that. It wasn't 120 pages. It was like what would have been like a 2-hour movie,
yeah.
But you know,
but it was fattened up by just the pacing that needed to happen and the scenery.
The pacing actually was similar to There Will Be Blood or to No Country for Old Men.
Absolutely.
There's scenes, if you read No Country for Old Men, in where Cormac McCarthy writes things that happen. For instance, when they're all when it cuts to the shots of Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin very methodically doing things in the hotel mm-hmm. rooms, like unscrewing vents.
Same thing.
In the book, it describes that in like one sentence. Then it's like the next sentence he does this, the next sentence he does this, and that takes 10 minutes in the film because they know that that's just tension for no reason, and you put that in there, and it just makes everything else that happens after it more, you know.
But it's also back to that whole sort of it's about somebody trying to do something, you know. In No Country for Old Men, it's about somebody trying to chase somebody else. It's somebody trying to be evaded. Somebody, you know, it's this sort of most dangerous game kind of hunt mentality going on there. In There Will Be Blood, it's about, I mean, at least at the beginning, it seems, it's very clear that it's about this guy's goal towards, you know, finding oil. Or at the beginning, it's silver and gold, though, right? At the very beginning. And it's kind of confusing in that sense, because it seems almost like he's in the same place when he goes back, and then...
It does kind of seem like it's in the same place a little bit, but it ends up being something where he's... you can tell once he goes from the silver and gold to the oil that... What he's just trying to do is make some money. Like that's you know,
well, no, that's relevant.
And he's being totally businesslike about it. And they never really give any sort of reasons. He the orphan son of a guy who dies on one of his oil drilling, mm-hmm. his first oil drilling. He takes as his own son.
Yeah,
and then introduces him at the first meeting where he's talking, and says, "This is my son. You know, this is a family business and stuff like that." And then the juxtaposition immediately after
my
that
son and the, partner, he says.
Yeah, my son and partner, and
HW.
There's some interesting scenes throughout the film is that he treats HW a very particular way when it comes to anything family like, and then the rest of the time he's very friendly and loving with his son when it's about the business, when he's asking him like if he knows what this smell is, and he's out there with his son,
nurturing,
hunting quail, so like that. In that sense, he is. And then any other time there's anything to do with just family, without the business, he's standoffish, and he's basically an abusive father without the physicality, is what he is. And it's that's the whole film.
I'd say he's a father without a mother that's there
like
to balance.
Yeah, he's totally negligent.
Well, where is he being negligent?
Constantly throughout it.
Like, and he just, like, gives him a bottle of milk or something with alcohol in it to, like...
Help him sleep, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Help him calm down.
Unless you can help me get oil or whatever.
Except for that one flashback near the end where it seems like HW is doing the remembering, but where he remembers one moment where they're kind of joking around with a whole bunch of the other drillers there around the campfire, the old thing. Aside from that, there isn't a single moment of warmth outside of
the business. Yeah, but that might have just been, like, warmth because he was in front of people, you know, like, acting and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah. He wanted people to think, you know, he was a loving
father. Obviously
you
saw it, too, but I just got the complete cold shoulder from this whole thing from him. That was because, like...
Pretty much, and, like, the son was detached and stuff, like, you know, throughout the whole movie, hardly talked.
Yeah, and I think that was because his father just didn't didn't give him any sort of attention like that.
His adopted father.
His adopted father.
Yeah, and he didn't know his
adopted. And, you know,
but he gave him. But he cared enough about him to help teach him some valuable skills.
Well, because he was planning on having this guy just be his, you know,
his next successor. His successor, you know? Yeah.
And then when it gets to the point, I mean, it's...
And he cared about him when his... I don't know, I think you're both wrong.
No,
I'm going to dispute
remember,
the abuses.
Do you remember this part? When you know, the oil came out, mm-hmm. and he got, you know, hurt?
Yeah.
His dad definitely. Put him in the house and he just left him there.
Crap about him.
No, he made sure he was okay
first.
Yeah,
he left him there, though. And then he leaves him there when his son...
He's like, oh, crap, oil.
He goes outside, and the guy's standing there with him. And he goes, and yeah. he's like, we understand this means we have an ocean of oil there.
He doesn't
and then
the
guy
goes,
he does. He
after
shakes
there's
him.
Been, the guy's
he's like, how's your son? He's like,
and then he goes, how's
no,
your son?
No,
and
is your son okay? And he's like, no.
And then the guy goes to check on him, and he stands there smiling.
Yeah, he's
the oil. He doesn't give a crap.
There's nothing else. There's nothing he can do for him at that point.
He could have stayed with his son.
Why did
he could just stood there? He could have just stood there while
his
son kept freaking out.
His son needed him.
He calmed his son down.
You wouldn't.
Look,
be with your son.
I'm not saying this isn't about what I would do, but I'm just saying that I think the character is more complex than that.
Oh, I think it's more complex by the fact that he was basically an abusive father.
We're not saying it's
reality.
Not complex.
I think that makes him more complex. Is that
what about when he beats the crap out of Eli?
Yeah.
When Eli comes, he's like, "Where's our money?" And he just starts kicking him and slapping him. He's lost it. That's a grieving father. That's not grieving,
I don't
but
think that was,
he's more concerned with his son being a freak than, like, you know.
He sends his son away when he had a chance to.
He sends his son. This is in 1911, and he sends his son to go learn how to communicate.
He sent him away because he caused the problem. He brings back the tutor. When he comes back,
the kid still needs the tutor.
Well,
the kid still got the tutor when he's married.
But the guy
in 1928.
The guy tells him when they come back, this is his tutor. He's going to be teaching him. Like, he hadn't taught him yet. So all he sent him away for was because he had a problem. Because
he
was neglecting
his
son.
He learned how to communicate, and he learned
when he came back. Yeah. So basically, like,
no, he had learned it while he was gone.
They showed it teaching
and
they
showed him talk.
Yeah,
to
like
his
right
friend,
when they got out of the car
to the secondhand man, to the right hand man about, like, well, how big is the room? Like, where is he? Like, he was concerned somewhat. He wanted to know how he was
well,
doing.
Well,
he asked.
No,
about
he's
room,
more
like,
he's more concerned
thing.
Like with making himself feel better. You know, like
mm-hmm.
he just wants.
I don't think so.
No,
I think it's a legitimate difference between the fact that he's got the responsibility of the men that work under him in this oil situation, and then his family life. With his son. His son has now been hurt. What can he do to help his son? He can't teach his son how to sign language. He doesn't know that. He's got a break with his son. And this is the sort of thing that probably happened all the time back in that time period, is that the kids go off to boarding school or
something.
But
he kept him there forever until he tried to burn down the house. He did it because he was causing problems. That's the only reason he sent him away.
That was a sign that he needed to do something to him. That woke him
that
up.
He needed to get him out of there because he couldn't.
I don't know. I think there's more to
it. Well, he basically thought, you know, his son was like broken, messed up, and he couldn't be his, you know, successor.
You're not useful to me anymore.
Yeah, his successor. He was basically just using his son. And he explained that at the end of the movie.
It's hard to talk about this stuff without talking about, like, the two main points of dialogue in the whole film are when he talks to the guy who says he's his brother in the middle, and then when he talks to
his son at the end.
And those are the two parts where you really get any insight at all, which is at the very end he explains to his son that he's worthless to him now that he sees him as a competitor, because he explained in the middle of the film that the only thing that's even in him is a hate for other people and a competitiveness that he needs to beat every other person. He needs to beat them. And that it turns into being the same thing for his son. And he tells, you know, he does the most devastating thing he can to his son, which is almost worse than what he does to, you know, Eli, by explaining to him that, you know, you're not my son, you're nothing to me. And I think that was the most powerful thing about him, is that he makes weak attempts to keep this family facade together throughout the first half of the film, and then when it's obvious that he can make all this money and he can be successful on his own, the son becomes just like a and when he becomes a hindrance, he just pushes him away so he doesn't have to deal with it. And then when he comes back, you know, he just can't handle it very much. He tries. It's not that he doesn't try. It's that he's not equipped for it, and he doesn't have it.
Well, of course
him.
He's not equipped for it.
But he doesn't have it in him, in his personality.
No, most people are not equipped for all of a sudden
no, for,
their
for
child, their child is Possibly, but he seems to have done rather well. He's raised his son to know how to fire a shotgun.
It's all business. It's all
like
business.
His son's like 8 years old, and he fires a shotgun when they're out quail hunting just fine. That's pretty real, though. That means he showed him how to do it. Exactly. That's something that a father would teach a son back then. He teaches him about the trade.
That was like...
It was a ploy.
They were faking going quail hunting.
There was no one else there. They actually were out doing that, though.
Yeah. They were just
and then you're also
the happiest point he has with his son is when his son comes up to him and says, "Hey, I found oil."
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he explains to him, "Do you know what this oil is?" And stuff like that. That's when they seem the happiest, when they're talking about business stuff.
Well, that's what they do. That's their goal. I understand. You know?
But there's no reason why that should be the happiest moment in a
If they were looking for bananas and they found great bananas and that was their do. Yeah, we have people that look for bananas and they look for bananas.
But don't you see the point that the only thing they shared as family was this business? That was all they shared. That was it. That's the whole point.
That's important, so, though. It's something that they didn't have anything going for them except for the business because they didn't play video games together. What else are they going to do out?
He didn't care about his kid except for the business.
Traveled with him at the beginning in the car.
Again, showing father and son. It was all like a facade.
It was a facade, and he even told him at the end. He's like, "I used you."
And you could say that's just because he was mad at him.
Yeah, that was why he did that.
It was the competition thing.
It was a little of both. I mean, naturally, he told everyone that it was his son, and he kind of played that up. But I think that he actually did have affection for the kid. He did feel like it was his son, and he did feel badly that he was leaving him, because his son was probably the only person that could understand him. And in the end, he was just being defensive, and he was just being... It's just old, typical old-time... You know, tragedy stuff. You live in the nice house, but you're miserable and alone because you've pushed everybody away. And his son's like, "I can't be around you anymore." And he's like, "Well, I don't love you, and I don't really care about you." It was completely obvious that it was defensive. And so I don't think it was 100% authentic. I don't think that's actually how he felt.
What?
I think it was mostly how he felt, though.
I don't think it was. I disagree.
I think it's pretty obvious that it's a really, really bad relationship between his father and son.
But just because he said at the end, like... He's not really his son. There's like none of him in his son.
He doesn't care because it's
I'm sure he made attempts, you know,
he cares about himself and
introducing him.
He kills the guy who says he's his brother when he finds out it's not. Mm-hmm. He disowns his son.
I was confused about that. Did you guys get when he realized that it wasn't his brother? He tells his brother there at the ocean.
At the beach. He's asking him questions. He started saying some stuff. He said,
talked about a house.
Remember the old
house? He talked about the peach tree dance or something like that.
Yeah.
And the guy said, He's like, "You know the peach tree dance." And he goes, Yeah.
Right, whatever.
And he expected him to react a certain way. And when he didn't, he started getting all, you know.
So
from that point
suspicious.
On, he was, yeah.
Okay.
And then it showed him, like, you know, in the brothel or whatever. And it totally showed a different side of their relationship.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that was happening before when he went back out into the ocean. And he sat in the ocean and you could see the waves crashing.
And then they went immediately from there to the
brothel.
Thing.
And then they cut to him, you know, doing what he needed to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is putting that guy out.
Out to pasture.
For sure. 100%.
So here's why, Blaine,
I want to ask you a question about this.
What?
Did he use it? It looked like he used a derringer to kill him. But
no,
then
it was definitely a revolver.
But was it the same gun that the guy tosses to him?
Yeah, it was definitely.
It looked different when he first pulled it out.
It looked smaller in his hand.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, because you only see it from like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if someone else had noticed that there was a difference.
I like how it was a small enough caliber that he shot him in the head and the guy whines for a while.
Yeah, that I like the touch too. Yeah. I did get a little afraid at that point because it was far enough in, but it started to feel like, oh my gosh, is this going to turn into a blackmail murder mystery thing? Like the guy knows. For a second, I got real panicked.
Well, the most uncomfortable scene in the whole movie comes when he has to
pretend.
I thought that was hilarious.
It was funny, but it was harsh.
Because the only time he actually showed any like real feeling in his face was when he had to say that he abandoned his son,
mm-hmm.
and then he looks like he's serious, and then it goes directly into him saying he was like
for the pipeline,
and then after that when Eli's like slapping around, he's like yes. God, where are you? And he's like smiling and stuff. Like he just thinks this is, after that, he thinks it's a big joke. Yeah. But
well, it is. It's a joke to him the whole time. But just that they're forcing this on him.
I thought that was like the best
breaking
like, performance
his
part of the film.
Oh, that was good. In the end, when it was reversed.
Yeah.
And I loved that he got to reverse it on him.
That and when Eli's character was doing the what, like that, not the exorcism, but on that old lady. I like
yeah,
that
he was,
like
he was the casting out the demon.
And yeah, that was, like the camera kind of...
That was a little yeah, weird, awesome. Though. It was a little like he was fourth wall in it there.
Yeah,
for a
I liked it, though. Like, I it was just, like, really
no,
weird,
it was
yeah.
interesting, but I don't know.
That was I was looking for that the whole film because it was. I thought that was the most powerful looking part of the preview.
Yeah,
they just show him like doing this thing and like looking out the door and you think like, what the hell is he doing?
But you're forgetting that this whole argument about the sun... You're forgetting when he, if his goal is just to make money.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, he wants this to be a family thing.
He just wants to beat everyone.
He's trying to make it pull together as a family thing, but he keeps realizing throughout the film...
He hates everyone?
Not just that, but that he tries to make himself care about his kid, but he just keeps getting pulled away by business and by what he's doing, and he... I think he knows at the point where his kid goes deaf and he doesn't give a crap and doesn't, you know, his kid's screaming and holding on to him. And he's like, here, just stay here. I need to go. And he goes out and he's all excited about the oil. At that point, I think he kind of, you almost see it in his face that he realizes that you know, that's his kid, the family thing that he was trying to make, he was trying to force on himself as an important thing. He realizes that he can't keep up the facade and that it's there, but it's not as important as he would like it.
Okay.
Like he would like to be a family man. But he knows it can't happen, and you
he's
wonder
an oil
like,
man.
But he's I, but he's, but he's said, stuck with what he's got,
right.
And he
right.
he does pretty well.
He
with
is
it.
An oil man, and if he really wanted, like you mentioned after the movie, you know, if he really wanted a family that bad, he would have just found some woman and knocked her up, married her, whatever.
But no, my, I didn't
woman.
Say that. I said
it was
I was curious
that he didn't.
I was curious about the fact that you could tell that one of the trailers that it was that whole line about. You know, all I want to do is make enough money that I never have to be around people. If this character is truly sort of a bona fide sociopath, you knew that he had a son, or at least from one of the trailers, this is my son, and you didn't know that it was an adopted son from the trailers.
Right, you didn't.
At least I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And so the whole time before I'm going to see this movie, I'm like, this guy's really this much sort of introvert and drunk. How would he have a wife?
Yeah,
and I mean, there are characters like this all the time that end up having wives and stuff, and usually they're very reserved, and you can tell that it's just a time period thing. And so I thought, well, it wouldn't be that. It would probably just be unexplored and uninteresting, or it might be really interesting. But instead, they just simplify it. And I mean, I don't know if you heard me, but when it became clear 25 minutes into the movie that this kid, this adopted orphan, was going to be his son, I just kind of chuckled a little because there was, oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So he never does actually connect with another human being
and
bring a child into the world.
I think it's really important for his character that they did that too, because at the very beginning, the whole reason he takes this kid at all is because of this guilt factor. Like, he's the reason why this kid's dad died, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, not directly. He didn't kick
very,
the thing
very
down.
Indirectly is that he's this guy's boss. He asked him to come work for him. Something happened. The guy died.
Yeah.
And now this kid is pretty much almost his property.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of, like, you know, he doesn't show disdain or coldness toward this baby that he carries, but...
He gives it a real
like,
ponderous
like he says,
look for
he,
for
he gives
a
it
good
some
bit.
Ponderous looks, and he... He pours a whole... He doesn't put a little bit of whiskey into the bottle. He puts a lot of whiskey in the bottle and just kind of shakes it at the kid's face. And he's like, there you go. And then on the train with the kid's reaching up and it, like, plays with his face a little bit. And he just kind of looks at it. And it's not a coldness.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, oh, what the hell am I doing kind of look.
He's
like,
trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And
which
so,
you can't bash him for that.
So I think that maybe as much as anything, like, that's the, like, the guilt he carries through the thing. Like this kid is... is like the remnant of the guilt he's felt because, you know, multiple people get killed because of him, because of his drive and stuff like that. And he kind of pushes over
this the job.
Yeah,
it's the job.
Exactly,
it's because people
and
die in
job.
Life.
It's you know, indirectly his fault. And since he doesn't show any care, it's like the manifestation of...
You're missing critical things that show that this is really less and less his fault than you want to attribute to it.
Well, it's not that.
One man gets killed on the rig, so they shut it down for a day and they have
right.
a funeral. He goes and he talks to Eli, who's trying to indoctrinate everybody into
right.
his crazy... Eli is the antagonist of this film. You know that, right?
Right, but he's a much eviler man than Eli is.
No,
he's
not.
Yeah, he really
I'm
going to
disagree
he's,
with you on that.
Well, that's fine, you're wrong.
Okay,
but,
no,
what
be
he
right
does
and disagree
is,
with you on
what
that.
What he does is that, you know, he has to have... he has to have this guilt to, like, help him feel human. So the manifestation of any guilt that he doesn't actually feel is in him taking care of this kid that he really doesn't give a crap about almost the whole movie. He kind of pretends
just,
like he does and tries to make
I think
himself feel like he does.
It's more of, like, exactly... I think you just have to take it, like, for what he... Like, literally, what he
oh,
says
yeah.
at the
oh.
end. Like, he only used him, you know, as a way to...
I totally agree. I totally agree.
Like, no, butter up that was, the townspeople.
That's obvious that he's just saying that he...
I think it's like
there's a little bit of truth
like
to it.
Specifically like that.
I think there's a lot of truth to
his
it.
His whole character.
I think initially that was what he was doing, but then he grew to have a tenderness.
I saw no tenderness or
none at all. Well, there's no effect, no real tenderness, but that's because...
He grows farther away from it as it goes along. Grows much farther away from it as it goes along, because he just doesn't... He gets more pushed.
The only time I saw him acting like a father is when there were... No, like, just like when there were people around, you know, that he had to put a show on for.
Okay, so when
I... Him and that little girl. Like, what was up with the
beating?
He
was really fatherly.
That was really weird. That was really weird.
He had morals and stuff about it. Like, yeah, they said the thing about that father having beat her.
Yeah.
That's right, when she doesn't pray, because Eli, the antagonist, has got everybody so indoctrinated on all this stuff.
And so he says to the girl with the dad, like, sitting across the table, that was really good.
He asserts it. He shows.
Like,
no, the dad...
The dad was really, like, he was pissed.
Yeah, he was.
He was mad, but he also knew that he had lost that power.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just get back to this thing about everyone that dies, it being his fault. First of all...
Well, it's not his fault.
No. And he shows that he does care, because he goes and talks to Eli about how, look, my men that are working on this, they need their rest.
Right.
You know, so they can't be at your church all the time, and then because accidents like this are going to happen.
Right.
He doesn't want
people
to
care about the men, it's because he cared about his business.
One in the same.
Yeah.
You know, if you treat your employees well, then your business will do well. That's just basic capitalism, you know. It's just you treat everybody well, and they'll be happy, and they'll work well, and they'll whistle while they work, and everything will be good.
He didn't want Eli and his church to succeed, like, you know.
Yeah, he doesn't want anyone to succeed.
It was basically competition, kind of. Like.
No. You're forgetting about the end, and we'll get to that in a second. But second of all, when he has to put his son down, he has to go out and take care of something, the well is on fire, and he has to go out with a sledgehammer and bust some things up.
He doesn't have to do it. Yeah. All those guys run out there, and the guy hands him the hammer, and he hits it, and then he drops the hammer.
He
runs up
two
the
or three
one,
of them.
And the guy hands him the thing again, and he hits it again.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't need to do it at all, you know. And then he stands there while his, you know, his kid was clawing at him and everything, you know, needing comfort, and he just
there's nothing else he could do for him.
And then his buddy
he
comes and
comfort.
Checks on him.
That doesn't amount to anything. The kid just
it's
needs
comfort.
To calm down.
You obviously
that's
don't
that's
understand.
I don't. Okay,
that's what a father does.
That's true. So I don't understand that. That's fine with me. So what were you? Okay, back to more with the son.
Mm-hmm.
The if all his only goal was to make money, then he didn't take $1 million.
That's because he could have made more.
When Standard
competition,
when Standard offered him the money, he was probably he was game for that first part with the what was it, Coyote Hills. He's like, Coyote Hills will give you, and he just goes with it. He's like, it's fair deal. He goes, boom.
Yeah.
He goes, that's a deal. And then he's like, what's the next one? And they're talking to him, and then as soon as the guy says, no, you'll be able to take care of your son, you'll be able, as soon as he started telling him what he should
that's
be
what
doing.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
he implies that he's not good at something.
Yeah.
And he says, I can win at anything, basically, is his mindset, is that anything you challenge him about, he can win, and he wants to beat you for any challenge. I think it's fantastic that he shows so much bravado to that guy, and he tells him, I'm going to find where you live and sneak in the middle of the night and slit your throat.
It's not that he was sad about his, like, he had
he
compassion
was angry
for his son.
Guy
he
was, called him out about
yeah,
it.
He was mad because, like,
this guy
he
told
failed.
Him what to do.
He didn't fail as a father. He failed at, like, you
and
know,
like
yeah, looking like a father. It was just like...
I think the reason why he decides to keep that instead of selling it to them is that they're implying that they can do it better than him. That's the most important.
Oh, well, absolutely.
They were looking down on him and, like...
Sure.
Like, he was talking down to him, like,
oh, totally,
like talking about his son and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, that's why. That's why he told him to go fuck himself,
because that's what they needed to be told.
That's
why I got the most, like, pathos for him, because he was... He got really upset when this guy basically implied, and he did. He barely even implied that. He didn't even imply
he didn't,
this
he
father.
Didn't say anything.
He was like, you know, you can help your son by doing this, and he's like, are you saying I'm a bad father? And he's like, no. You know, like...
Are you saying I'm short?
Yeah.
Who are you calling a shrimp?
Exactly.
Okay, back to Eli being the true villain of the story, and his real motivation. It wasn't just this, like, that Eli was competing with him, because Eli wasn't competing with him. In what sense was he really competing? Eli's not another oil man.
Well, he was... He tried to be in the end. And it was more like
that's irrelevant.
Like, he was a church.
For money, for success.
People were like... He didn't want him to have success with his church, because, you know, people were going to his church and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
why do you think that was, though?
Well, because
out of his sheer competition?
He just hated like he thought of Eli as a liar. I don't know if it was like more of a
Eli say at the end?
That he's a false prophet and God is a superstition.
Which he just did to get back at him.
Yeah,
which he had always believed.
And like when he threw Eli down in the mud, remember in that one scene?
I'll bury you in the ground.
Like it was more he was like angry that you know, he said that he's a healer, but he couldn't heal his son. Yeah. And he only cared about his son being healed so he can, like, you know, carry on the oil pie.
You're adding that extra interpolation to it.
I thought the best thing about him putting him in the mud like that was that came after he'd been baptized at Eli's church. And the baptism process...
No, it did not. It was way before.
Yeah, and that's why Eli, like, smacked him around a lot.
Oh, that's right, yeah. But it's like, the exact same, like, thing. Like, you know, the baptismal process...
He baptized him in oil.
Exactly. Like, involves, like, the pouring of water on the head in that case, or at least usually the dunking the head under the water.
Mm-hmm.
And he does, like, the exact opposites happen between these guys all film.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have the same, like... I'm not going to say evil, but, like... incredible flaws in them that drive, like Eli doesn't have the competition as much. He just kind of is like a shyster who wants success.
Well, they kind of hinted that there was a competition between him and his brother.
Eli's less forthright about it though. He hides behind religion. The oil man says what he is from the get go. 20 minutes into it,
he
tells you
family. No. He hides behind family. He doesn't care about.
He has a son that he takes care of, and so what? I mean, but in the end, in the end, you know, he says what he's going to do, and he does it. There's an authenticity to the way he lives, and there's a complete and utter falseness to the way Eli lives, and that's what he makes it his myth. He breaks him at the end, and he wins.
I think that the thing between them
literally
is
and figuratively
is that Daniel sees that they're almost the same person because he always says, "I believe in plain speaking." But he continually lies to people to get what he wants out of business. He's continually making stuff up and telling lies and going to places under the facade of hunting for quail and pretending that he doesn't know that there's oil there. He's doing this. He's basically, I think it's...
But they know that there's oil there when they make that agreement.
Right, but at first he's like, he pretends like he doesn't know there's oil there. And so I think it's, what's brilliant about the film is that it's like, the thing that Daniel hates about Eli is that Eli is like him. And that's what he hates about him.
And there's definitely a duality between the antagonist and the protagonist in this film. And that's why it's a good movie. Usually that's what makes good stuff. Yeah. Obviously,
Almost interchangeable.
The protagonist pins the antagonist in the end. Yeah. And so,
well, because he's pretty much the antagonist, too. It's just like, you know, they're basically antagonizing each other.
And then... he's finished.
That was pretty awesome.
He's finished. It's a great finishing line. Yeah.
Basically, this review that we just did was us talking about the movie because it was that good a movie. We didn't bother with any real plot.
You didn't have to talk about the plot. The plot is kind of
no. And the truth of the matter is, if you've seen the movie, then you'll understand this. And if you haven't, then maybe you'll be driven to want to see it. And I think you still will feel like you don't know what's going to happen in some respects. And I mean, there's two sides from it. I argue that Plainfield. The Daniel Day-Lewis character is the protagonist, and that he does, in fact, have some legitimate feelings, fatherly feelings for his son, or that they grow, and that they're hinted at in tiny, tiny levels. I think you guys are maybe also thinking, this was back when being a single parent was a much more rare thing, so... honestly, I don't know who would have been a father.
I think it's basically like you take it as at face value, like we were saying.
Yeah.
Just
okay.
You have to. Yeah. I like that. One thing I couldn't help but doing, but you know, he really tried to, or P.T. Anderson really put a lot of, almost everyone in this was someone that you haven't seen for the most part in the movie. And then when Kevin J. O'Connor comes in as the guy who says he's his brother.
Who's in FX2.
Yeah, FX2. But
him and
I just think
him and Psylocke had quite a plan. I kept waiting for Psylocke to show up.
Psylocke should have shown up.
Oh, my helicopter.
His plane's helicopter could have landed right on the oil field, right in the derrick.
But Kevin O'Connor is, every time I see him in anything, I just think of the ridiculous voice he used in the Mummy movies. And every time I saw him, I kept thinking he was going to scream at O'Connell that they had all the horses. and that O'Connell would scream back that you're on the wrong side of the river. And the whole movie kind of gone on from there.
Yeah, you get trouble breaking yourself. The illusion was broken.
Yeah, the illusion was broken at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you started...
O'Connell, we've got all the horses.
Once you started seeing the mummy in, in the middle
of it. Yeah, Arnold Vosloo should have been in it, too.
Okay, let's things you didn't like, things you did like. I mean, in terms of maybe specifics.
This movie is like... It's the timeless thing about, basically about, like, this guy who's, like, a personification of something. And there's really almost not anything that could be anachronistic about it, because it's set in this really minimalist
area. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you'd be more likely to... I was reading about...
You'd be real petty if you were getting anachronistic. You'd be like, you know, they probably couldn't have made a cup like that.
I don't even know if there could be anything. Like, you know, I was reading something about the movie Zulu Dawn from 1979, mm-hmm. and they were like, this movie is very, very accurate, but there's still a whole huge list of inaccuracies from the time period, because it's also, you know, set back in the, you know, late 1800s or whatever in South Africa, and they're able to find a whole bunch of things because it's a vast thing about the specific time and about these people who wear these certain uniforms and use these certain weapons and stand mm-hmm. in certain formations, and this is like a character study.
I'm trying to think of any things. I think in terms of the length, it was long, and
it was long, but I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it.
I didn't mind.
I think there was two or three little bits that could have maybe been shaved to make it a 215, 220 instead of 238. I think that would have been possible. Maybe not at the beginning, because I just really, mm-hmm. really like when it's all showing and no telling. I mean, you know, there's no words. It's just stuff happening. And the fact that he just sort of pushed himself through, I don't know how long, they didn't even bother with it. They just, you know, he had a busted up leg and he just had to drag himself back to civilization.
Right. And then I like how they're checking, they're marking down how much the gold and silver is while he's laying there with his leg in that like makeshift splint, and he's just kind of laying on the floor like while they do that. Yeah. You know, like,
that's what you do, you know?
He dragged himself all the way to this town to get his money.
Say what you, there's something sort of, I don't know, clear and concise about this character that I liked. I can't say there's anything particular. I did think that the scene in 1928, they show the nice house that he's got, which does seem kind of odd for his character. That's because it's a huge leap in time. But then you see all this fanciful stuff that he's got.
Remember he was talking about that one house.
Yeah, he was talking about the brother, and the guy says, "Well, you want to build that same house?" And he says, "No."
He
built a nicer house, probably. Yeah, and by the ocean, maybe, but you didn't really see that. But then
I think it fits his character because you know he always wanted to be bigger and better than everyone else.
So kind of, but I didn't get an ego.
All this stuff, and he like was shooting at it, so he didn't like. He really didn't care.
And that was another weird thing. That just seemed like some kind of like Faulkner kind of thing. That's just a crazy guy. He just shooting stuff.
He has made all his money. He pushed away
like,
all.
What
people.
Does he do after that?
And
he's still making
he does
money.
All he does is drink. And since the competition hasn't been brought to him in a while or something, because that's what kept him moving for the whole time.
That's like the end. Remember the end? Like he kills him and then he says he's finished.
There's no
he's
competition.
Finished. He literally says he's finished.
He's pushed away his son as competition. Yeah. Well, he hasn't. The son's still there as competition. That's what pissed him off.
Yeah.
You are now my competitor.
The son has told him that he won't be gone forever too. He says no, I'll just be for a while.
I'm just gonna go to Mexico and start a company.
And
you are now my competitor.
Makes you my competitor. You know, that's just him being honest with his son. Mm-hmm. He's saying, "Well, if this is what you're going to do, okay, then I'm going to be honest with you." This
what about
is the way
performances? Let's talk about performances.
I think we can talk about performances. I thought Lewis was fantastic.
And what's the guy who plays Eli's character?
Paul Dano.
He was good. And then that was pretty much it. Everybody else was very straight. They were just like. Caesar, I always call him Caesar because I don't know his damn name. Caesar,
Sirenhines,
the right hand man, was good. He was very straight, but he kind of had to be this sort of weird, like I'm uptight, but that's the only way I can kind of deal with playing field. Everyone around him, Kevin J. O'Connor was good, but he kind of it seemed like I'd
really
gotten
subdued,
sort of subdued
because he's usually
character.
Kind of screaming or something in most of the movies I've seen him in.
Yeah, he's kind of a weirdo usually. So I'd say, you know, there's really not a lot to say so much, except that the performances all worked for the style of film. It definitely felt like a Kubrick kind of film.
I think one kind of standby that people go to when you're making a period piece is you just have actors come in and say the lines, because it's kind of hard to say, hey, listen, act like you're in 1920, because they might start going all crazy and pop, you know, tossing around quarters and saying C.
Exactly.
So, like, if you watch them like Road to Perdition, besides, like, the principals in that film. Everyone else just kind of talks, and they just wear their hats and they wear their suits and mm-hmm. they just talk.
Another film about a potentially evil character and his son, huh?
Yeah, well, that guy's actually a good, you know, that's one of those bullcrap ones where it's a good guy who does a bad, you know, mm-hmm. what I do for a living is I kill people, but I'm cool.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. What I do for a living is I make money from oil, but I'm not an evil person.
But he's good to his kids in that movie.
Okay.
One thing in this movie, though, that, like, kind of confused me, I think. When you know, the kid got in the accident and he mm-hmm. was deaf and stuff, and he looked in the guy that was saying, you know, he was the brother.
Yeah.
He looked in and he found the diary.
Yeah,
he burned the house. Yeah. I was wondering if that was in relation to why he burned the house.
It probably had something to do with it, because at that point, I mean, you saw many moments where he's looking at them and this guy is now hanging out. You know, his dad is now hanging out with this guy who says he's his brother, and you can tell he's looking through that because he's trying, you know, why is he basically, like, forsaking me for this guy who just he hasn't seen him forever, who says he's his brother.
Do you think he knew he was a fake, though?
I don't know.
Like a phony?
I don't know.
Because he had his real brother's
diary. What's interesting about that is that Daniel Day-Lewis kind of, you know, once again pushes aside this kid who's not his real son to reach for someone who might be real family. Yeah. But then again, that's not super important because he could just go back east to his actual family if he really wanted to.
Yeah.
But this guy comes and he's it's almost like it finally turns into a family business.
And the guy was like, kind of, it was like him, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly. He looks a little bit like him with a mustache and stuff.
So he was honest with him about his bad past. To some degree,
exactly.
He was honest.
Yeah.
And he was useful.
He was useful.
Yeah. And that's very true.
And that became like the real family business at that point, because he brought him everywhere and he was with mm-hmm. him at every moment.
Yeah.
Once that guy came in, he was there
like
with
the
him.
The meeting with Stan. Or
exactly.
Union,
yeah.
What was
it? Yeah, it was. But that's because he helped him mark off that track for the.
So it's like this guy that he thinks may be actual blood family then takes over for the son who is just kind of a bother at this point.
I think it's just because the guy shows up and he's viable to him. I mean, that's overly
simplifying the whole thing.
You look too deep into the son's relationship.
No, I don't look. I just can see that's what's going on there. And the other one, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he kills the guy because he's. I mean,
well,
obviously he kills the guy because he feels
betrayed. Like,
well, he does
feel
betrayed. It's like,
but
he
also now knows that he can't trust him. Is mainly what it is. He knows he's let him in this far.
Yeah.
But you know, honestly, if the guy had come to him and not given him the line about the brother, but said, "Here, I was traveling
well,
with the guy,"
if he had told him the absolute truth.
Then he might have been in a he would have been still alive.
Yeah, but he also wouldn't have given him that position of he being his,
like,
new right hand man and following him around as the family business.
Well, that timed with the son, with the other guy taking the son off though, right? So
he comes back after the son has come back.
Yeah.
The guy shows up after the son.
Yeah, and that sort of times with after the brother's been dispatched as well.
Like this, you know, my son is now maimed and kind of useless and. Mm-hmm. And so here's this new guy to take his place, kind of thing. And I think what is important is that, like, you know, ostensibly this guy is blood, and,
mm-hmm.
and there is no blood with HW, and that seems like to be something that always is a little bit.
And
of
he saw himself
in
in the guy.
Well, he wanted to. I mean, Plainfield's only really sort of vulnerable in those two scenes that you talked about, where he talks about his character.
Yeah.
When he's getting drunk with the guy,
he
thinks it's his brother, and he's trying to figure out if it's his brother.
Was where he explains that. That was just so
there's nothing aesthetically all that interesting about it. It's like by candlelight, it's all close-ups
mm-hmm.
or medium shots, but he's just talking about, you know, I mean, there's something in me.
He just explains it, and it's devastating, because everything you've seen up to that point is basically him describing that, but you think, I wonder if there's something else there, and then he says there isn't. That's what there is. That's what I am.
Well, he says
that, like,
though.
But he's saying that in close confidence to this person that he's completely opened up to, and it's like that's when he's being the most real.
He's testing with that guy, though. I mean, you know, you don't. If that's actually the way you are,
I think
100%, and you're not looking for something more. It's the whole point of, like, if I'm a bad dude and I tell you I'm a bad dude, that probably means that I know that things I've done are bad, which means I can distinguish good from bad, and that means I probably can appreciate the value of good.
But he hadn't been testing him at that point yet, because after that, he's happy with him until he asks him the questions on the beach.
Yeah.
And so I think what he is what he's actually telling him that is, he asks the brother guy
It doesn't become
questions.
Important to him until after the deal, because that's when it really could become a profitable situation. He's like, now it's important that I figure out this guy's my brother.
Yeah.
Now that I'm in a position to relax, you know, and he wasn't even testing him then about the thing. I think it just happened. He was actually very relaxed.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it just occurred to him, and he's like, you know what? I got to figure this out, because if this guy's full of shit, and I'm gonna let him in on a percentage of this big deal, that's not going to happen. This guy's a liar. Yeah. He's done. He's got to go. And, you know, boom.
I liked how, like, right after that scene on the beach, like, they showed him, you know, in the brothel, like, and
just glowering.
Like, you could see, like, their relationship, like, a whole other side that they haven't showed before, and which is probably, you know, been around, like, him mooching off of Daniel Day.
I guess, but I thought that was the one thing I thought
was poorly
done.
It's like he was blinded by, like, the fact that he thought he was his brother, but, he can see, you know, like, through all...
As a character study, I had a problem with that, because at one point when Eli is berating him, he's saying that he's sinned and done this and done that, and that he's sinned with women and stuff, and there's been no interaction with Plainfield and women that's shown to us in the entire movie, except that he's sitting
that might have been one of the things that cut out.
And
I heard they did cut a great deal out, and I don't remember everything.
And that could have added an extra level of what's really going on with this character. I mean, like, his relationship to women, which is pretty non-existent, Mary.
Yeah.
And that's not really a relationship to women so much as just a relationship to a girl.
I think the problem is, as soon as you bring in a movie like this, I think it was wise to cut that out, because... But then they left it in
Eli's thing, and you could just say that's just generic, throw it in there too, it doesn't matter.
Well, it could have been just been
something Eli was saying.
Yeah, he doesn't have a wife, and he has a son too.
Exactly, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like, you know, the only people that asked him what happened to his wife was a woman, and when he said she died in childbirth, and then
he said
she died in childbirth.
I know at one point he was just evasive.
That was the time with his brother. He said, I don't want to talk about these things. Yeah. But then a woman said, what happened to your wife? And he says, she died in childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Actually, he didn't say, I don't want to talk about these things when with his brother. He turned it around on him.
He said, don't talk about these things after somebody asked him.
Yeah. That was not with his brother. With his brother, he was still pretty sharp.
So he did it three times.
I took note of that, because whenever someone's going to ask me a question I don't want to answer, I know now that you always just ask them a question right back as if to completely make it about them. They're the one that's being interrogated, not you, you know? Which is something you always got to remember.
But then right around that is when
you can
also
lose power being an intellectual.
You know, lets the guy in. Like, he's asking the brother about how he is as a person, like his personality. And then when he answers a certain way, he says, well, I'm like this, and he explains it exactly how it is. Then he says, so you have to have some of that in you. And it's interesting that, like...
He's bled all that blood away, right?
And it's great direction, but it doesn't... They don't do some lame thing like showing Kevin J. O'Connor going like, oh, yeah, that's true, and like some sweat going down his face or anything. He just kind of sits there and is like, you know... Like, this guy's a cool customer. Like, he knows how to pull a scam.
But it's almost like he's not really lying. It's like he's another person that's been through a situation.
Yeah.
And then this
other
guy...
Yeah, he's almost not lying. Yeah,
well,
he's the most friendly, nice person.
He feels almost like he's not, you know? Like, he just sort of... I just sort of took his place, you know?
The most friendly, nice person in the movie. And he's just looking for family. And he's just looking for, you know... It's like he's taking this guy on as his own family because he's looking for it. And at the same time... Yeah.
I'm tired, huh?
Yeah. I just thought it was great.
Okay.
So in terms of, like... Did you want to talk about any more stuff before grading it?
Well, he kind of looked like the brother kind of looked like a scumbag, like when he was in the brothel.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
No, he was.
Yeah.
That was the
truth
of it.
But he did seem pretty nice.
But other than that, he was like the nicest person.
Yeah.
I think that, I don't have anything more to say. I think I'm, you know, we've kind of depleted it.
We've both had our disagreements about the character, and so the audience will have to make it up for themselves as they see it and listen to the podcast or whatnot. I'm going to give it, I wish there was something between an A and an A plus, because I'd never want to give anything an A plus, but I think I'll just give it a solid A, you know?
I think A is as high as it gets.
Yeah,
I can't get something an A plus. And at the very end when he says, I'm finished, not only is he talking about the competition with Eli, he's also like, this is it, I'm done, my whole person has fallen apart. I'm completely done.
Yeah, but he has sort of an exhale to it. He's gotten
it is
because when you get old, you quit caring on some level. You don't care that much about the fight.
Well, it must be a relief to him at that point that he can kind of, you know. I mean, it's got to be tiring to be constantly competitive and hateful for everyone. You know, so
it is. This is not a good night to try to do a serious one, is it?
This is about as serious as it gets.
Yeah. People are going to start drawing on my arms.